Hi there. Welcome to Sound Healing Radio. This is David Gibson, and our guest today is Randy Masters. Hi, Randy.
Hey, David. All right.
Our intention or show is about the sound of love today, but the intention is may the sound of love resonate ever more in your heart and ever stronger. But before we get started, I wanted to tell you a few things that are happening at the school. You could actually jump into our online sound healing program this week if you are interested. Randy's one of our instructors. In fact, he's teaching this week as well. And you could also start in a couple of weeks if you'd rather as well. We have our Sound Healing Certificate and Associate Degree program starting up on January 17th at the school here in San Francisco. We also have our online and our classes on audio recording, sound healing audio recording at the school starting January 17th and online starting this week if you're interested. It really works out well. Also, we've got a couple of events coming up. We've got a meetup we're doing on 11-11-11, and we're going to be resonating some of the higher energies that are happening on that day. You have any brief comments or thoughts about 11-11-11, Randy?
Well, the basic numerology of 11 is like two beings, and the ancient pillars of Boaz and Joachim represented basically two polarities. And so when you see a one by a one, a lot of the temples have pillars like that as an entrance. And then as you walk through the pillar, you know, you basically are purified. And a lot of times one bows and does various kinds of ceremonial gestures, etc., when entering the temple. So one thing is you pass between the pillars as a way of purifying, as a gateway to go into the next dimension. On a more microscopic level, one has to pass through an eye of a needle, so passing through some types of pillars represents enough cleansing to not take one's baggage with them because it gets stuck in the eye of the needle. So when you have an 11-11, that can be either... One 11 can represent two sides of one pillar, and the other 11 can represent two sides of another pillar, so it can still represent two pillars, or it can also represent four pillars. And there's a lot of course, entrances to temples where you see four pillars. And then by the time you've got three, you have like a really big gateway. The other thing is that when you add 11 plus 11 plus 11, you get 33, which is one of the really key master numbers. It's also a key number in the Tree of Life, in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. And, of course, in Masonry, there's the degrees above 32 that start with 33, a few degrees above it, which is a deeper level of Masonry than all the 32 degrees below that. Like the reality changes once somebody gets into the 33rd degree. Then so there's a lot of different, basically I use the whole number code when 11 is inside of a number, such as even in 440, that number is a multiple of 11. And you break it down by octaves to 55, so 5 times 11, and then you multiply that by 8. So there's a lot of inner codes, but the whole number scene built on 11s is very important. So I believe that the really 11-11-11 is really a very crucial gateway. However, when they do that with the date, you know, you have November as an 11th month, and you have the 11th day of that month. But saying that the year 2011 is an 11 is not the whole truth because, you know, 2 plus 1 plus 1 adds up to a 4. So it's not 100% purely the next 11. It is by removing the two, and so it's kind of almost by default.
So we're going to have to wait 100 years before we really get
yeah.
the full deal.
Well, a lot of other dates will add up to an 11.
Uh-huh, right.
So, you know, cool. there's a number of ways to do that.
And then there's also the whole thing about these crystals that are being activated every year, 888, 999, 10, 10, 10. And they're saying that there's enough of them being activated by 11, 11, 11 around the globe that it's going to create this whole grid. It's starting to really, we should actually feel it by then.
Well, even an urban myth could be generated by the thought field being picked up by people and synchronizing with that thought field and believing into it and energizing it to where the certain realities could happen just by the mass of thought and attention that's given to it.
Uh-huh. Cool.
The opposite of like a 9/11, you know,
right.
in terms of a positive. By the way, 2018 is an 11 year.
Oh, cool.
So that's our next one.
Oh, nice. So also, while I'm thinking about it, I mean, today, it's some people are saying today is the end of the Mayan calendar. Is that... I was thinking it was December 21st. I mean, what's the deal with that?
Well, there's a number of different researchers who have analyzed the Mayan calendar and compared it to other calendars that have been off because of how the Gregorian calendar was set fictitiously. So that throws a lot of historic dates off if you're referencing to the creation of the Gregorian calendar. And Carl Kalman's website talks a lot about the 28th being, in his estimation, as I understand it, the real completion. And then today is sort of this void day for creating a whole new context.
Wow. I've been getting amazing energies coming in today, just really getting chills and my whole, you know, all the glands in my head lighting up with chills. It's really been a pretty amazing day.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous day here, too.
So also on November 13th, we have an open house if you're in the area. If you're not in the area, get on a plane. Come on in. We spend the whole day talking about sound healing techniques and everything we do at the school, but we also do tons of meditations to get people as high as possible and then really still. Really still. That's the deal.
And what time will that start?
It's from 1 to 6 on Sunday, November 13th, if we're still here then.
And by the way, my next radio class is a week from this Thursday.
Oh, okay. Oh,
yeah, right. There's some.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot. Right. So today we're talking about the sound of love. And, you know, the reason I really got interested in talking about this is because of everybody talking about the 528 hertz, and I keep hearing people say, well, you got to be tuned to 528. What? Your music's not tuned to 528? Come on. You know, and it's like, God, you know, there's a lot more than just frequency in the universe. There's frequency. There are timbres or tones. There is the music of love. And then there's the energy of love. So last week on the radio show, I talked in detail about this, and I've also sent out an article that talks about this, and you can read this article if you go to soundhealingcenter.com/love.html, or if you just go to the site soundhealingcenter.com, you'll see it under About Sound Healing. And so I wanted to, you know, just get a wider perspective with your experience, because I know you've been doing this for well over, you know, 10,000 years.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out what universe I started this from. Some things have had to been updated along the way, though.
Right. Maybe that's 10 million years.
Yeah. Well, I did research with Joseph Paleo, who was written up in the book Healing Codes for the Biological Apocalypse. And in that book, a tremendous amount of information from Joseph Paleo, who passed away a few years ago. But he was a naturopath and a Bible scholar and spoke about six languages and was a number code translator. And so, you know, he discovered another whole number code in the Bible that's not that one that was written up in a book called the Bible Code that was all based on a computer. It's not that at all. In fact, he disproved that other one. Uh-huh. But in this particular...
I'm sorry, who did
Joseph
the Bible Code?
Joseph Puleo.
Uh-huh. And who did the Bible Code?
I don't remember the author that did that book.
Okay, cool.
And people will see that word associated with titles and articles and things. But there was a book that came out that was a game, basically, of working the stuff, the information through a computer. And they said, well, you could find out, you know, Martin Luther King's assassin and John Kennedy's and all these names are in there. But that was not an authentic, true Bible code and how the alphanumerics work. They associating numbers with every letter in the alphabet, and then whole words have a number, whole phrases, paragraphs, and there's an entire science called gematria or gematria. Both are proper, and also called alphanumerics. And Joseph Puleo was an expert with that. So I spent 6 days up at his house soon after the book came out because I discovered a whole lot more about those first six numbers that everybody's talking about being the original solfeggio. And I personally considered that a lot of cultural myth information and disinformation has been going out about what those numbers really mean.
Uh-huh.
I don't say that, you know, I mean, there's channeled information mixed in with it and different kinds of interpretations, and it's just taken off all over the world, and people are doing things. So they're certainly, their thought field is adding momentum to it.
Right. If people are just, you know, even if 528 meant nothing, the fact that all the people, there's so many people tuning into it and resonating love, that it's creating its own field that is actually positive.
You can take an urban myth that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And create one. But 528 has significance in Hebrew and Greek and all in the ancient texts. One of the things it means is the truth. 256 is the word for truth from Hebrew. And the truth is the number 528, but it's also the key, K-E-Y, for 528. So those two definitions right there are very auspicious. And then we look at the earth grid, and the ancient megalithic mile was 5,280 miles. In other words, 5,280 feet in a megalithic mile. That was an ancient measurement number way before the modern British Empire. So, and it's still used today, and they call it the British mile, that's how long it is. Mm-hmm. But that number, which is built on 11, is completely built into the Earth's measurements because there's 7,920 miles in the equator, in the diameter at the equator of the Earth average, and that number is a perfect fifth above 5,280. A ratio of 3 to 2. So that locks it into a stability as a number musically into the Earth grid. And then there's a lot of other numbers in the Earth grid that have 11s built into them. And certainly if you look at the measurements in crop circles from point to point here and there, almost the entire old diatonic tuning system based on 528 high C and 264 middle C, all of those numbers show up in feet and inches and yards completely in crop circles, and those numbers also show up in Stonehenge, in the ancient measurements of Stonehenge.
Wow.
So it's a grid number,
mm-hmm.
But I do not equate it with
love.
All that meaning about the love that goes with it.
Yeah. Now, are there any other... This is great. Is there any other frequencies that, as far as frequencies that you would say are akin to love, or have some connection to the energy of love, at all?
Well, basically, in our normal hearing range from, let's say, 16 to 20 hertz at the bottom up to 20,000 plus, to, depending on people's higher threshold, it can go a little above that. In that frequency range, I doubt that any single note necessarily puts people into a true state of the emotion and the dimension of love. Mostly, you have to have an interval or an interaction of at least two notes, and sometimes even a triad to create a certain type of stability. The single fundamental, to me, isn't generally strong enough. However, if you get into extremely high frequencies, ultra high, and also ultra low, ULF and so on, it's possible to resonate the organs in the body and to resonate certain glands in such a way that it might stimulate particular hormones, and right. then that could put somebody into that state.
Particularly the thymus, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then also working with the pituitary, pineal, and the thalamus and hypothalamus and some of that, the master glands in the head, if those could be tuned. And I can imagine very, very high frequencies that people can't physically hear, mm-hmm. but they would still be impacted, which could also be broadcast using currently available technology in the world. A frequency like that could be broadcast to, you know, people gathering in the various Wall Street scenarios.
Uh-huh. As opposed
and protesting,
to the frequencies being
those people could, somebody could fly over and or using a satellite and could broadcast love.
Zap them with love.
Absolutely, instead of maybe some other things. That.
Now, would there possibly be a resonance if we found those super high frequencies and then did the mathematical calculations to octavize them down or convert them to frequencies that we can hear? Would those you know, if that frequency that resonates the thymus happened to be like a certain super high frequency above our hearing, it's going to be a certain note, right?
Absolutely.
So would that note possibly be a resonance, or how? Because it seems like. Well, what do you think?
Well, there are certain phenomena whereby you have to hit the nail on the head with the exact frequency and the exact octave for a particular phenomena to occur, you know, and there's a lot of different things that resonate in these extremely high. The law of the octave puts you into a domain, and that every octave below that, you're a little bit farther out on the edges of that domain to the point where it might not resonate. You can prove that by making a resonator box with a tuning fork on it and play the same tuning fork, touch the tuning fork stem to the box, and the tuning fork mounted on the box will resonate. And then you can try other tones around that, and it won't resonate that way. And then you can try different octaves. Well, all of a sudden, even though there are octaves above or octaves below, isn't going to resonate it exactly the same. So that doesn't rule out the value of the law of the octave. It says over this chapel in Cluny, France, the octave teaches the saint's bliss in Latin. I thought that's very interesting music of the spheres comment to have on a church. So I have a lot of respect for doing things that are octaves below phenomena. That's how the whole Hans Cousteau cosmic octave book that he wrote, by taking these different planetary frequencies, and these are the frequencies that acutonics used for their tuning forks to place on acupuncture points and such, based on these calculations of orbit times and converting that into sound. And then having to either octavize up from something or octavize down from something. And the notes, the tones have proved to be valuable, but they aren't at the same octave. One thing that really caught my attention about this part, about how far you can be away from something by octaves, is in the Paul Nogier tissue rejuvenation frequencies. they're built on, there's a set of seven of them within all of his work, built on the number 73, which is also a number that's found in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life on one of the Sephiroth. Anyway, that's a D note. And then it goes up, so you end up by octaves till you have seven notes. The next note will be 146, and then 292, and so on. Every one of those octaves addresses a different level of tissues in the body. Like the, in other words, 146 doesn't address the same part of the tissues and the layers that 73 does, or the next one, 292, does.
Wow.
Now, I was found that very interesting.
That's really interesting.
And the way that that work was first delivered, and they use it, vets use this in little LED light devices that pulse the lights to these frequencies. And every setting addresses, so in other words, you put LED lights in a device, and then you turn it on to a certain setting, and then that LED will flash like 73 times per second, or the next setting 146 times per second. And those flash rates with a particular wavelengths of light affect different layers of the skin and the muscles and so on.
Wow, maybe there's different octaves of love.
I feel that there is.
That's interesting, because, you know, we always think of, you know, personal love or love for babies or unconditional love or spiritual love or, you know, even love of my, you know, my car. You know, I mean, and they seem to be, I've always felt they're kind of, the essence of them are the same, but somehow, you know, they're definitely different. I mean, when I'm in love with someone, you know, that's really quite different than me just like loving an object.
Yeah.
You know, it's
you know, some people love their computers more than they do humans.
Right. Right. Right.
So to speak.
Yeah, that would, so that might be, but then, you know, it makes me start to think about also a whole energy that spans multiple octaves.
Well, they've done some measuring, and some channel information has talked about it. I have charts that talk about, you know, how many million or billion hertz or more for the speed of thought and various types of things that are way, way, way up there, up in the areas where light vibrates. There's different types of love, and I believe that each one has its resonant field. There, you know, there's, okay, the love of, let's say, objects, and then which goes along with gratitude and appreciation. Mm-hmm. And then there's the love of pets, for instance, and animals or plants in the garden. Then, let's say, there's romantic love or various types of love for other human beings, from platonic love to friendships to love that's not like the intimate level of romantic love, but high levels of love, the kind of love where you would give a person would give their life up because they love another being and they would sacrifice their own life.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very interesting states.
Mm-hmm.
Then you move into unconditional love,
uh-huh,
which most people feel is one of the highest states of love, but actually there's another state above that, which is unselfish love. And in unselfish love, there's no expectation of receiving anything on any level from the person that you're extending love to.
How's that different from unconditional love?
Well, a lot of times people think that they're loving unconditionally, but if you really have them tell the truth, they're expecting something in return,
uh-huh,
a lot. That doesn't mean that's the case every time. There's a book that talks about this, Lost Children of Atlantis by John Peniel, J-O-N and then P-E-N-I-E-L. Children of the Law of One is another part of the title. And what that book is about are manuscripts that are from the ancient being Tehuti or Thoth, that were stored in the Himalayas in a monastery. And he got to see them and talk to other monks in that monastery and get translations of those ancient tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Law of One that Tehuti taught, and there's other books of the raw material from the Ra being from ancient Egypt, that in that and those teachings are the teachings of Thoth or Tehuti, and the highest teaching was about unselfish love. So this book has the best descriptions of the differences between unconditional love and unselfish love.
Cool. You know, it's interesting, in the classes, on the Sound of Love class, I actually start out by showing a diagram of love going one direction towards something. And, you know, that's like loving something that's not loving you back, whether it's an object or even, I guess you could say even an animal, although animals, I guess, love you back as well. But then there's like where there's a connection of love going in both directions, like you're in love. And that actually creates a resonant field around it, which is really powerful. And then if you get a full room of people that are sharing this vibration, that resonant field can be huge. And if you get millions and millions and millions of people on the planet sharing that vibration, then you've got a resonant field that is so huge that it could easily entrain other people around it, or ultimately the rest of the planet, into that vibration. But then there's the whole aspect of spiritual love, which is like a resonant field. And some people talk about bringing universal love into the heart from outside. And then other people say, well, we are love. There's love within every cell. So there's two different, even in spiritual love, there's two different ways people seem to access it, by either just resonating it or by bringing it in from above or outside them, often into the thymus and into the heart.
Well, I would suggest possibly that an amendment to that process is to bring love out from the individual.
Uh-huh, cool.
Saying that it's in there, not something that has to be input.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting, when you look at people, when they transmit love, you know, to someone else, or when you receive love from someone else. So there's kind of like a different paradigm than the one of we are love. Because, you know, some people say, well, just resonate love. But I feel like it does work to actually send love over a distance to someone, especially if they're sick or not doing well or have some really, really challenges. And, you know, I feel like I get that energy from people, you know, as well. When it's sent.
Well, there's stories, it's, you know, of people who have been in prisons and were tortured, and they got to a place where they loved the torturer.
Wow.
You know, they understood that the torturer was in a certain position, and most likely, if they were going to keep their life, they weren't going to be able to not administer the torture, and that they just had ended up in that place and that station in life. And so the person being tortured didn't hold it against them and love them. And sometimes the torturer knew it, but had to still carry out that act. Now, whether they got a chance to apologize to the person, say, you know, don't take this personally. Difficult situation. But, you know, that nevertheless, they didn't carry the person being inflicted by the torture, did not carry it into any hatred toward the person, or animosity or anything, and didn't carry it in general past this life experience, chances are, if they survived the situation, because they completely forgave them and extended love to them, and out of that maintained an integrity in their field, not wanting anything back, not saying, I'll love you so much that you will not torture anymore. I mean, this is an extreme example, but there's been interesting studies about this type of thing, including people falling in love with the torturer and so on. And, you know, that's carried into all kinds of human activities that are extensions of this particular thing. So, you're basically looking at the torture and saying, look, whether you know it or not, I know that you are love, even though these actions aren't loving actions.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty heavy duty.
Yeah.
And
aspired to that in our
recently
lives.
There were some photos going around on the internet of this ranger, a Caucasian ranger in Africa, that all these wild cats lions, tigers. You know, he just hangs out with them, can put his arm around them, they hug him, and they know that he's taking care of them. And there's a complete loving energy like you would expect, what I call the St. Francis effect.
Right.
Where, and I also had a friend who was on a trail out in nature in another country and had scorpions crawl all over his body, and none of them bit him because he was not resisting
right.
whatsoever.
Right.
Now, these are examples of maintaining a loving field whereby if you could measure that person's pH, their heart rate, the heart-mind love in their field, they would probably be running a very alkaline pH in that state instead of a type of acidity that would cause a snake or an insect to bite the person. And for that creature to realize that even though this other being is bigger than they are, they have no threat for their life whatsoever.
Wow.
I was practicing that the other day with a fly. You know, they're just, you know, come in a, you know, half an inch of the fly and be talking to the fly and not have the fly be afraid and have to fly away or anything. It just, you know, that's fun. That's my little insect
cool.
meditation.
Cool. Well, you know, also there's the work from HeartMath and others that shows that when you're transmitting love, your heart actually creates a heart rate or a sound in the heartbeat that has golden mean ratios in it.
Yeah, and the key to what you just said there, well, two, golden mean for what kind of ratios, and the other was the word ratios, because that's not a fundamental. You'd have to have two minimum
right.
to create that.
Uh-huh. And so, but that's,
you know,
actually
8 to 5, for instance, or 13
right.
to 8, or any other two numbers that create a golden mean minor 6 ratio.
But even further, it's really a flowing, changing ratio, right? Right. So it's a changing ratio. So it's in fact, one aspect of that is the heart rate getting faster and slower based on the golden mean. So it's a ratio that is although it's staying somewhat consistent. Well, it's not changing, huh? The ratio itself is staying consistent as it goes up and down, isn't it?
Yeah. And then there's a certain rate where the mind, the brain-mind field, and the heart are in synchronization, and the way it is in sync is in this phi ratio,
cool.
as I understand it. It gets a little bit technical as to where each one of the numbers in the measurement is taking place.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Because you could have a brainwave that's, you know, 128 hertz, and you could have another one that adds 1.6 to that, you'd have 129.6. Let's say the simplest phi ratio is 8 to 5.
Uh-huh.
That's the, you know, from the Fibonacci series, the musical minor sixth interval, like a C up to an A flat, or a middle E up to high C being that in certain tunings. And so you have to have that particular ratio minimum to create that phi ratio. So I would think then, to experiment with pairs of tones in golden mean ratios to find out if certain pairs put people into a more loving vibration, or whether there's specific fundamental frequencies that are also in phi ratio, or whether you could change those fundamentals but keep the ratio the same, and would the pure ratio of almost any two notes be able to convey that?
Uh-huh. Cool. Well, just so people that don't know about Fibonacci and the golden mean, these are patterns that are, of course, found throughout nature. It's in the body. It's in the spiral in the conch shell. It's spiral in cactuses and flowers. It's in the galaxies. It's in everything. Now, it's interesting. This is really brings up a thought here, because, you know, the golden mean in musical intervals is like the minor sixth.
If it's 1.6, then that's the minor sixth. And then if it's 1 over 0.618, the ratio will still turn out to be 1.618.
Uh-huh.
You can get other notes. Before you get to phi squared and phi to the third power and all of that type of thing, phi times phi, it continues on. But the basic ratio is the 1.618 to 1.
Uh-huh. Cool. So check this out. It's interesting that, you know, is it mostly the third that most love songs are based around? The musical third, is that right?
Or, major and minor thirds, you have that. It's interesting, though, that the theme from the 70s movie Love Story, it's in A minor, and the first 10 notes is a high C going down to an E. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then it goes further from there into other intervals. So the first 10 notes is just a C note and an E note alternating back and forth, and if you tuned it properly, that would be the Phi ratio.
Oh, wow.
And,
wow. I was just going to say, I didn't know that there were any songs that actually used the Phi ratio in the love songs.
Well, that's my most profound example, just about.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of songs that have it. Mañana Carnival from the movie Black Orpheus, also called A Day in the Life, and Morning of the Carnival, the first two notes, A Day in the Life of a Fool, like C, A flat, it's another minor sixth.
Uh-huh.
Starts right out that way.
Wow. But a lot of songs are thirds and minor thirds as well? And,
mm-hmm.
and even use fifths a lot, too, as well, huh?
No? Yeah. Now, I'm not aware of the fifth creates stability, and the perfect fifth, 3/2, and the perfect fourth, 4/3, also creates stability.
And love, and normally love like takes us out of stability.
Well, you know, yeah, that's an interesting statement there.
I guess that's loving relationships, not love.
If it's going to go anywhere, because seeing a perfect fist is not going anywhere. It's just sitting there, and
uh-huh.
no note has to move to resolve.
Funny. That's funny.
You know, metaphysically. And a lot of the insurance commercials that you hear, and a lot of the little melodies that, PC, all those little melodies when you open the computer and close the computer are full of fourths, fifths, and some whole steps. But that fourth and fifth interval predominates
mm-hmm.
because those intervals convey a certain kind of stability.
Uh-huh. Cool. While I'm thinking about it, back to notes, are there any particular keys that you like to, that if you were doing a song about love, that you would play in?
Well, I've played songs about love in props every single key.
Uh-huh.
Overall. And I can take a song about love and transpose it to different keys, play it on different instruments or on the piano or guitar, and play it in different keys and get different effects. What's interesting, though, is in World War II, a predominant number of the popular songs that were written in a major key were written in the key of E flat.
Wow.
Major. And another reason for that also, because the swing music in the big bands, by having the saxophones and trumpets, trombones and all, being centered around the B flat pitch a lot, even the E flat alto sax, E flat baritone sax, and the B flat tenor, B flat soprano, and then the B flat trumpets and so on, clarinets. That key flowed very well. Now, if you take that same song and put it in the key of E major,
mm-hmm.
it's way more tricky for all those same instruments
mm-hmm.
to play, or D major.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Pachelbel Canon is in D major. It'd be interesting to see what would happen if you play the Pachelbel
right.
Canon up a half step in E flat major.
Yeah, it would be interesting to try it in all the different keys and see
yeah.
if people are still affected by it, huh?
That'd and so
a perfect test.
I've written love songs in different keys and still maintained that feeling of love in the song, and I did not have to transpose the song to necessarily have a better effect. If I transposed it, it might be because of the instruments that I wanted to feature on it so that it would be in a certain range, or alto voice versus soprano voice or tenor or something like that. And then you massage the keys until you find one where the song lays into the key in a real comfortable way.
Cool.
And so because the singers are going to be more comfortable in certain keys, they're certainly going to be able to get into the feeling more because they're not straining too high or too low to deal with it.
Yeah.
But I look at the psychology of keys and how they feel, and the whole world of keys has been altered because of going into equal temperate tuning.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get the individuality of each key on a, for instance, on a keyboard, at least, because it's kind of, there are subtleties, but the grosser ways that keys were different is completely missed in that tuning system.
Yeah, the ancient tuning systems of just intonation and Pythagorean that are based on the harmonic structure of sound, when you go from one key to another, the differences between the intervals frequency-wise is really quite different, whereas in equal tempered, it's more similar.
Yes, exactly. But I do work with that on the piano, and if I want a song to be darker, I can take a song from D or C and put it in D flat, and it will have a different kind of magic. And if I did that in just tuning on a keyboard, and I would set the just tuning so that it revolved around the fundamental of D flat, or the G flat in that scale, either way, and then it would even be more pronounced. But those, certain of those keys are very magical. So that's an important aspect, even in equal tempered, to find keys that are either brighter or darker. Beethoven considered the darkest of all keys to be B minor. That's why he wrote his Mass in B minor. But yet, its relative major, D major, is a very bright key. One of the bright keys, like B major, A major, G major, D major, E major, all those keys right there are all very bright keys. But the B minor, he felt, that's interesting that a very bright key in D major becomes, in Beethoven's experience, B minor being the darkest. He even said that the color that comes off that key was black.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, so he was very intentional in putting his Mass in that key and not writing his Mass, let's say, in A minor or B flat minor or C minor. See?
And he's in just intonation, so it's really much more noticeable.
Well, actually, you know, they were using equal tempered then, and there's a bunch of tuning systems during the time of Beethoven, and the equal tempered was, you know, beginning to take off. So it depends upon... if it's if you did something for orchestra and art and voices where all the fixed pitch instruments are removed, that would mean the xylophones, orchestra bells, pianos, harps and such. You take all of that out of the equation. All the rest of the musicians can deal with the just intonation and no matter what key you're in. But as soon as you put one fixed pitch instrument in there, then you have to lock down the tuning system.
Got it. Now, you know, it's interesting. I've come to notice that, I really believe different people resonate love at different keys or based on different notes.
Mm-hmm.
And this could possibly have to do with their soul, but it could also very likely have to do with the key that they naturally speak in. Because, you know, I speak in the key of G, and this becomes pretty apparent when you do the voice bio voice analysis.
Mm-hmm.
You can see what note is the main note they're hitting, which is often is the key they're speaking in, not always. But that's really interesting, because what I've found is when a person speaks of something they really love and they really bring that through their voice, they go to a lower note of the key that they speak in. So, for example, if I say, I really love my kitty, right?
Mm-hmm.
I really love my kitty. I go right down to a low G every time because G is the key that I speak in.
You're not so just lower in pitch. You're just lower in the same key for you, your G key.
Yeah, yes. Lower. I'm going down to a low G.
I see.
Yeah, yeah, which I'm going to G. I mean, the key of what I speak in. So I found that's pretty much the case. So I've actually, whenever anybody wants to find the sound of love for them, that's one technique that I use to actually have them speak of something they love. And sometimes they'll go, oh, I love my kitty. And I go, oh, no, you're not bringing it through your voice. Or sometimes they'll bring it through their voice, and they'll go to a fifth, and I can hear that they're not dropping down into the home note of their voice.
Yeah, so they're not really experiencing the love. It's more an idea.
Right, right, Exactly.
Can you measure that with anybody? You can actually find what key they speak in?
I'm sorry, say,
can you measure with anybody what key they speak in?
Yeah, we can, you know, what I can just hear it in someone's voice. And in classes, we actually, I go around the entire class and I have everybody speak. I kind of think, that's the note I speak in.
Yeah.
Right? And you speak for a second and I'll tell you what key you speak in.
Well,
no.
Yeah. I transpose a lot.
Yeah,
I've gone chromatic.
You're about the same too. You're
testing,
right around there.
Well, I'm now picking up with you and
yeah.
To communicate with you. I shapeshift. I would like to know and have you do a more careful study with me on it. I'd really like to know because one of my teachers said that he was kind of amazed that I could detune off of my core to talk to somebody without losing my center.
Yeah, this is it. It's not the same note as me. It's actually a couple notes lower. That was it. Yeah, that's the note you're at in your voice.
Well, you know what's interesting in the work of Tomatis, I think it was in his book, The Ear, and you know, it's his second big book that he put out. It's called The Ear and Language. They studied people in different cultures. Like, so somebody speaking English in England is speaking in a different pitch band than a person in France or Italy speaking English. Now, I'm assuming complete command of the English language. Okay? So you can understand their words. But what they found, though, is if you're speaking to a French person, and let's say English is higher pitched than French, for instance. I don't remember if that's the way that went, but let's say for a moment that that was the case. They won't get all of your communications the same as if you raised up your pitch and spoke in the realm that French-speaking people, in other words, the pitch window that French people speak in.
Boy, you know, it would be really interesting research is to study where people go when they say, I love you, in different languages.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
I'll bet there are some pitch windows connected with that.
Uh-huh. I mean, yeah, that would really give us a lot of info. That would be really interesting.
And whether they go, and also different kinds of love. If they were to love somebody in the unselfish love that I was mentioning, with no expectation, they're not loving them to get anything whatsoever.
Right.
Where do they go as opposed to if they're loving somebody and having expectations of a reciprocal.
Right.
Because to me, in like maintaining a good relationship with someone that you love, if each person loves unselfishly, you don't have to worry and take stock of whether love is coming back to you. You're not loving to get it because both people are loving not to have to get it back. They both love and they completely feed the field of their relationship.
You know, it's interesting. When I go into that state of pure, unconditional love, where I'm really feeling that energy, you know, I think of it as a ray, or like a ray of a rainbow, like one frequency of a rainbow from Source. Because that love, unconditional love, feels like it's connected to Source. I'm connected to this, like, this perfection as well, you know, when I'm in that state. It's interesting. I always think of it as like, I mean, if I were to make the sound, which, you know, when I was in Egypt and I went into that state for a couple of days, when I make the sound, it's like, that's what, for me, what it sounds like. Not to say that that's for anybody else. And it's interesting that music doesn't often just go to that high note when it's actually expressing love. Music often is very sad around love.
Mm-hmm.
But love is not sad. The truth, I mean, it's when you lose love, it's sad. But for the most part, love is a very high, not sad at all frequency.
Well, there's a realm, I understand what you're saying, and that's a very key observation. There's a type of love that's called longing, that when you track it back to what is the longing about, ultimately, it's about longing for oneness with the Creator. And by having that longing in the field, which can interimly be interpreted as a sadness, but it's a good type of a sadness that's motivating you to seek and accept the flow and unveil your oneness with the Creator and live accordingly.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really can transform the whole pain.
Absolutely.
That people get out of this longing for a relationship or loss of relationship, you know?
Because they project it on the person to fulfill what really they should be going vertical. I call it going vertical.
Right.
Connect with the Creator of all that is, and then relate horizontally to people and other things, but not expect them to provide the type of love that is our responsibility to let in and have and commune with our Creator.
Nice.
And a lot of people project that on relationships, and when their relationship with the Creator is wobbly, then they go looking for that in their relationships with other human beings, and for a while they may be fooled thinking that they have that because, of course, they've got energies of passion, which is different, and more down in the red and scarlet areas. And then you have more another kind of neutral part in the rainbow, the middle of the rainbow with green.
Uh-huh.
And then if you mix the violet part, let's say way high up with the in that spiritual realm, with the red you get magenta. And I think one of the colors of love probably would be magenta.
Nice.
Oh, I think a lot of the Valentine's cards need to have at least green thrown into the mix and magenta. And you look at the leaves in nature, some leaves are green on one side and shades of magenta on the other side.
Nice. I've always felt that, you know, if God put this all together so that, you know, to try to get us, I mean, where love is the ultimate of just being in the zone, then, you know, that's why he's made so much greenery around the entire planet to remind us if green is you know, the heart chakra.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I love that analogy to see it as a full range of colors from the full spectrum of love.
Yeah,
that's nice.
And so, different emotions, and there are love songs that are sad, you know, about losing love or wanting to gain it again. But I think a real key that a lot of songwriters are not clear on is about the longing. So that gets translated into love songs that are about finding love and losing love and being sad for that and all the things that go on in human emotions built around finding and losing and expecting somebody to be something that they maybe aren't.
I think they should teach in kindergarten techniques for connecting to universal love from the beginning or reconnecting what we've taught the kids that were connected in the beginning as babies.
Yeah.
Teach them, you know, to reconnect, you know, and teach. I mean, that seems like that's the most important thing, because when people are connected to this universal love, there's no, you know, neediness. You don't need someone else at all.
No. Then it's preferences for a different purpose.
Right, right.
Not fulfilling a void that we need to fill with the isness of who we are, the love that we are. Pretend that we aren't without somebody or, you know, that type of thing.
We've got about 5 minutes. Do you have any a short meditation that can bring us into the zone? I've got one if you don't have something.
Well, something that I really like to do that I teach a lot is the golden flower meditation.
Cool.
And the purpose of that is to run the currents of the Father of creation, energy coming down as a gold and white energy coming down from the cosmos. And the listeners can just go along with this as I'm describing it. And you feel coming from as high up in the heavens as you trust, a source that you feel is absolutely pure, this gold and white light coming down through the crown and going through your body, all the way through your body and out your feet and down into the earth. Now, that you do on the inhale. Then on the exhale, you bring up from the center of the earth this dark energy, but it's not dark in a negative way. It's dark because it's like the void that has all the colors in it. It looks black, but, you know, it might be. It just has every color in it. It's the deepest aspect of the feminine aspect of creation. The goddess of all goddesses is coming out of this black, dark energy in the void. And it's filled with love and every possibility. And you bring that up in your exhale, up through your feet, up through your legs, up through your body, and out your crown and up into the universe. So you mixing on every inhale, you're inhaling the Father energy, the Father of all creation, and when you exhale, you bring into your body the Mother of all creation. So it's the Father, Mother, God blend, and run that field every day. And I often do that like about 20 minutes at a time. So it's interesting that when you're exhaling, you know, that you're actually absorbing the feminine energy. When you're inhaling, you are absorbing that the male part of creation. And in a lot of breathing techniques, if your exhale is longer than your inhale, you are helping to calm your nervous system, the parasympathetic nervous system and such, can be calmed. Whereas if your exhale is greater than your if your inhale is greater than your exhale, that builds up more energy and more possibly even adrenaline in the system. So that's something, a little subtlety about rates of breathing. So now we're talking about a love that's outside of any duality, but does have the natural polarity of male and female energy blending in your body, and the idea, in your whole field actually, the idea is to resonate so much with that then all your other actions come out of the whole of a blended field.
Nice.
Yeah.
We could now take this energy and send it to everybody that's listening on this radio show. Send it to everybody else who's listening now. Resonate it and send it and receive it. So we got all directions at the same time. And then that whole resonant field can also tap into all of this love on the entire planet at the same time.
This is everybody's birthright.
Really powerful field that ultimately will entrain the rest of the planet. So we're all in that zone all the time, and it's hard to get out of it. Thank you so much, Randy.
Yeah, thank you, David. This is fun.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's incredible. Thank you. Again, our intention is, may the sound of love resonate every heart ever stronger. And you can always hold that energy and this energy from tonight through the evening and through the rest of the weekend. And hold it through the week. Imagine holding it for months to come or years to come. Or
be held by it so you don't even have to hold it after that.
Right.
Becomes the standing wave of your being.
Yeah. Lifetimes.
Yes.
Nice. Take care.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Take care.